Hey everybody, thanks for listening to this episode of My First Sketch at MyFirstSketch.com. I'm Josh Heilm. Any questions, thoughts, recommendations, feel free to email me at josh@myfirstsketch.com. I'll get back to you as soon as I can. Like the podcast on Facebook at facebook.com/myfirstsketch. It would be really cool if you rate it 5 stars and leave a review wherever you get the podcast. So many cool things are happening on the horizon in the sketch comedy world. Our friends at Toronto Sketch Fest start their festival next week. Our friends in DC start their festival later in March. Philly Sketch Fest is coming up, and you can still submit your live act at phillysketchfest.com/submit2024. Philly Sketch Fest takes place over 2 weekends, May 31st through June 8th. Head to phillysketchfest.com for all the info. But let's look at the more immediate future. Sketchball, our show designed to debut new acts, returns Wednesday, February 28th, with the debut of In Action Network. In Action Network actually grew out of Cutthroat Sketch, as two teams who were randomly signed together decided to combine forces and continue working together. So, February 28th, Sketchball featuring In Action Network and with J-Nim doing some musical comedy to open up. 7:30 p.m. at Plays and Players, the Skinner Studio on the third floor. $15 tickets are available at sketchballphilly.com/tickets. Today's guest is a member of An Action Network, T-Nut. T-Nut's first sketch is called Dr. Dentist. T-Nut reads the dentist, I'm the patient, and I also give you any of the stage directions that you need to know. So let's get to the sketch. Dental assistant walks Bill in.
Mr. Chadwick, please have a seat. The doctor will be right with you.
And the dentist walks in.
All right, Mr. Chadwick, let's take a look at those chompers.
He puts on gloves.
Ha ha! So, how are the kids?
The dentist puts his hands in Bill's mouth.
Oh, that's great. Little Billy's off to UPenn. For dentistry? Oh, wonderful. No, shouldn't be much longer now.
The dentist removes hands from the mouth, takes off gloves, and looks at the chart.
So, Mr. Chadwick, have you been brushing 3 times a day?
Yes, I have.
Flossing too?
Yeah, flossing too. Dentist reads the chart, looks at Bill, reads the chart again, looks at Bill again.
Really? Is that what you were doing November 17th at 3:05 p.m.?
Yeah, I think so.
Interesting. It says here you were eating taffy in Atlantic City.
What? How could you have possibly known?
What about October 23rd, 9 a.m.?
No, I was at work making phone calls.
Really? Making phone calls. Isn't it a little hard to be making phone calls with a double glazed Krispy Kreme in your mouth?
Wait, what?
August 15th, 11:30 p.m. Were you flossing?
My birthday? What? I don't...
No, you weren't. Chocolate cake with sprinkles and not 1 second of flossing. I sent you floss.
All of this is in my file?
Oh, fantastic. Last week, you had a 5-piece bagel, popcorn, and spinach. No flossing. Not even one tooth. Are you aware of the consequences of not flossing?
Yeah.
Gingivitis. And I'm talking the life sentence, buddy. Bleeding gums for life.
Ugh. I didn't realize.
Of course you didn't.
Stands up, talks to the audience.
None of you do. Sure, brushing helps with the big stuff, but what about the little things? What about the specks that get into the nooks and crannies? No one ever thinks of them. Oh, flossing is too kind. It's time-consuming, they say. Denture care is a lot more time-consuming. That's why I installed homing devices on all my patients. They come in for a crown or filling. Now I can track all of their meals and flossing.
Isn't that illegal?
Nope. Thanks, Patriot Act.
But not flossing isn't an act of terror.
Oh, isn't it? Not only is gingivitis the leading cause of gum disease, it is also the greatest terrorist of them all.
What? You're saying gingivitis is the leading cause of terrorism?
Exactly. What do you think drove Hitler, Mussolini, Chavez, Bin Laden, Walt Disney, Bush, the other Bush, and all the others a lifetime of terror and mayhem? The gum disease gingivitis. Not one of them had floss or a dentist to save them.
Bill realizes his negligence and looks at the dentist in a new light. How could I have been so negligent? Jeez, Doc, I'm sorry. Got any floss? The dental assistant walks in and pulls floss out of her bosom and hands floss to Bill.
Doctor, your 3 o'clock is here. Oh, good, Governor Corbett. That mouth is filthy, full of lies and tartar.
My name is Samantha Russell. I'm a sketch comedian, and I have a prop and costume hoarding problem. So I figured the best way to get it under control is to start a podcast. On Should I Keep This? I chat with other comedians about their experiences in comedy and our insane prop and costume collections. And on each episode, we both bring a beloved item to discuss whether it's a treasure or just trash. Sometimes it turns out no matter how much money or time we spent on a prop, the only thing we should be holding on to are the memories we've made along the way. So check out Should I Keep This? We have new episodes every 2 weeks available anywhere you get your podcasts.
Hey, Tina.
Hi. How are you, Josh?
So tell me where the sketch comes from. Where did this idea of the dentist and the floss?
Sure. So way back in the day, when I got my footing in sketch and improv and stand-up, I was part of a group in Reading called the Reading Theater Project. And we had a thing called Quick and Dirty Theater. We were a variety show. And we just had like a powwow sesh type thing, and we were just kind of all around. And my friend Bill was talking about how he hadn't flossed in like a year. And I just like, you know, no judgment, you know, you do whatever you got to do. But I just like had this idea of what if like a dentist of his freaked out, because we had a dentist in our hometown that was kind of crazy. And so I just started writing this. And then I wrote it for me specifically because I love being big, crazy characters. And so I was just like, what if I just like yell in his face and like just go off the rails? And that's kind of what I wrote. And that's it.
I wonder what it is about dentists. I feel like the trope of like, you know, the doctor patient kind of sketch. I think dentists are always another level.
Yeah.
To that. Yeah. Like, I don't know if it's because the hands are in the mouth or whatever.
The tools. But I think it's the tiny, tiny little prickly tools make them extra scary. And it's like I'm terrified of the dentist. Like I have, yeah. Like
not a dentist person either.
No, I would rather, you know, go to the gynecologist like 3 times a year than go to the dentist like once. So like, it's just, oh my God, I hate it so much. And then maybe I was working through my fear when I wrote this as well.
Like, yeah. That whole thing with Seinfeld and the anti-dentite episode.
Yeah.
I'm on board. It's okay. Like
absolutely.
So okay, so you're in Reading.
Yes.
With Quick and Dirty
mm-hmm.
Theater. So what is that about? Like what got you involved with that?
So there's a little group of us in college. I went to Kutztown University and a couple friends of mine, and that's how I got started. I started doing stand-up in college, and we made friends with some people in Reading, and my acquaintance Vicky, she was starting up this theater with a bunch of her friends, and they wanted to really do some improv, and I had just started getting involved in improv. I had taken a bunch of improv classes like in college, and so we were just kind of like roughing it. We had no formal training. Like I remember us like talking about UCB and all of these things, and so we just kind of like on gut instinct just started doing stuff, and people liked us, and we kind of got a little bit of a following, which was nice. And then I graduated college, but I still wanted to do this, so I would actually drive from Lower Bucks County, which is like 40 minutes outside of Philly, all the way up to Reading. So it was like an hour and a half drive one way, for like rehearsals and stuff. But it's really where I got kind of like my memory and my muscle memory and stuff going, and really getting my chops. And because I had no formal training, I could really make any mistake I wanted, and like, work through it. And that's kind of where I started figuring out what worked and what didn't. Because, you know, if you write something and you don't edit it and you go live with it and you don't get a laugh, you learn pretty quickly what doesn't work in a sketch.
Yeah, I think. Yeah, that first, as great as it is that first time you get a laugh, it's more important that first time you expect a laugh and you don't get it.
Yeah. Like,
that's a very important moment too, that I think people don't give enough credit to.
Yeah. And what was really cool is that, and I don't like doing this anymore, I think, because each one takes a different like type of capacity, but I would open the show doing stand up. Then we would do improv. So we do short form games. I didn't even know what long form was at that point. And then we would do sketches. And then either I'd go back to do stand up, or my friend Richie would do stand up. We would do more improv games. And then we would close with like a sketch. And like, that's really hard to do. Like when I came to Philly and I started doing stand up in Philly, I remember I would have to ask the runners, be like, can you please either put me on first and then another team and then my improv team, or like something, because I hated doing stand up then do improv, like to go back to back like that, because it's like it's a different type of skill. And so I was really grateful for that, because I learned that really early. And like, I think it forced me to think on my feet, and why I think I was able to jump into stuff so early on was, I was like, oh yeah, I could just do this, it's fine. But now as an old woman, I'm like, I don't want to do stand up first. I want to do sketch comedy first.
Yeah, I can't imagine doing a show where I was doing all three different disciplines, like in the same show. Like that feels not like a great idea to me.
It was hard, but I think because it was billed as a variety show, it was a lot of like friends and family that were there, and that part of Reading didn't really see much like that. Now it has this really amazing vibrant theater community, and my friend Vicky and the group over with Reading Theater Project have a lot to do with that. And like West Reading is a really cool part of town too, which is really nice. But yeah, I think it was just, I think also because we liked each other so much and we had so much fun with each other, because we all were friends and we all loved collaborating with each other, that it felt, I think the audience felt like they were in on the joke too, which I think really worked. And you can tell that, right? Like you can tell when people really like working with each other and like make each other laugh, which I really enjoyed. But yeah, I think like now this is what, 13 years ago, 12 years ago. So like, not like a material that we're working with, but enough where like, you know, we got people to laugh and, you know, we made some silly jokes about, you know, farm life or whatever, and people got it. But yeah, it was definitely, I'm really thankful that that was like my starting ground when I got involved in comedy.
And you were making the commute from Bucks County, you know, outside of Philly, like on the, I would say like the northeast end.
Yeah. Yeah.
To like, I always got back in the day when I was in my first sketch team and we were meeting downtown, I live out in the suburbs, and I was getting pissy that like I was taking the train into town and I was always like the first one there and everyone else was late. And then I realized that like two of the guys were coming in from Allentown, like even further than I was. A dude was coming home from work from somewhere out in the suburbs. I forget where he was too, but I was just like, why are we traveling so much? Like,
I think for me, it was like, I think comedy can feel like such a foreign concept. Like, well, I can't do it unless I do it in a very specific place. You know,
I very much had that growing up. Like, I thought like if I had any desire to do any kind of comedy, I'd have to move out of Philadelphia. So when I found out that there was a scene in Philadelphia, like it was such a revelation for sure.
Oh yeah. And I think I felt really safe in this group in Reading, because I had friends that I was friends with in college that I had really liked. They were like, I was at first I was a theater major, and then I realized I couldn't get a job, so then I switched to communications, but I was still friends with theater majors. And so like having that background is really helpful. But it felt very safe. And like when I did come to Philly and I finally made my way this way, it was really intimidating when I first started. And I first started just doing stand-up, and I mean, the scene is very different now for women and you know, non-binary folks and anybody on that spectrum. But back then it was really, really tough. And like, I mean, I know the Raven is still like that. Like maybe you'll get bumped and maybe you'll be there till 2 or 3 a.m. But like back then with me, like having to go down to that very scary parking lot like that late, it was just really, I just didn't really have the gall to do that. And also not being confident in my material like that. I think that was really hard, where it's like, yeah, these jokes are really funny in Reading, but is it gonna, are they gonna pan out here?
Yeah.
And I had this idea that like, I had to come up with new jokes every time I went to an open mic, like every single one I had to come up with new jokes. So it wasn't like, I didn't think that I could workshop the same joke in different places. So I was trying to generate like new jokes every time I did an open mic, and I was going to like 3 or 4 open mics I could a week, and I was like, I can't do this. It's like, yeah, dummy, because you don't like, and I didn't meet anybody really until a little bit later. But then at that point I started doing improv, and I just kind of went and did improv for a while. And then while I was doing improv, I discovered sketch. So I kind of like slowly moved away from stand-up. And a lot of like my sketch material came from my improv stuff, so I'm thankful for that. But I started, so in 2013 is when I also started taking classes in Philly for
like, okay, before we start into Philly stuff,
yeah,
let's go back.
Sorry, yeah,
let's please. Go backwards. Do you have like an earliest memory of comedy for you, like what were you like,
oh yeah,
what was that first like, oh, what's this?
So kind of a downer, but it's whatever. So it was my, so I have two. My first one was when I would stay with my grandma, and she showed me Modern Times for the first time with Charlie Chaplin. And just that physicality was really, really inspiring to me. And I remember that being a first like memory of like, that's really cool. But my first memory of like, oh, this is something that I need to be doing, was my freshman year of high school. My mom had passed away that year. And I remember like, I need people to not look at me this way. Like, I don't want to be the sad kid who has a dead mom. So I like just started kind of making fun of myself and like a very typical way of getting into comedy. But I also would watch old episodes of Saturday Night Live after the new episodes, and they would show the old episodes from the 70s, and Gilda Radner like with hook, line, and sink to me. I was just like, I want to do that. I want to be that silly and stupid and funny. So it was like those three things.
Yeah, I forget who it was about, like who said it initially, but the idea of like getting into comedy to control why people are laughing at you.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's a very real thing. And I ask everybody, and I think, I assume I know the answer already, but like I ask everybody, who's your favorite SNL cast member of all time?
Of all time? That's, Ooh. It's going to be Sherry O'Terry.
I love when she comes up, because from that era of that like late 90s, mm-hmm. she was my favorite of the women. Like, same. And I don't think she gets enough credit or love. I don't understand why she's not on a sitcom. I don't understand, like, and maybe it's entirely her choice, but like,
sure.
But why isn't she awesome everywhere?
I know. And I think for me, just my comedy style and the way that I even write, like I think there's something to be said for satirical comedy, and satire is really important. And the people who can do satire do it really, really well. I am not one of those people. And I know that's not my place in comedy. My place in comedy is to find the absurd and make it silly. And I think Sherry O'Terry has always done a great job of that. Like the one character who's like constantly on like a million pills and stuff. Like, it's just so brilliant and so funny. And she's not afraid to be ugly. And she's not afraid to like be the butt of the joke or whatever it is. And that's something I really always admired. And I was like, you can make fart jokes really, really smart. And that's something that I think she taught me, was that like, you can be like the bottom of the barrel, but at the top of your intelligence, which I think is really, really hard to do.
Yeah, that's another thing that I always like, that people don't understand, is like how smart you have to be so dumb comedically sometimes. Like,
oh my God.
Sherry Terry, like, I definitely would like light a torch for her, be like, she does not get enough love.
Mm-mm.
Like, even within the, like, I've asked every guest I've had on this show their favorite And I think Sherry O'Terry's only come up like once or twice before. I feel bad saying it this way, but like when people say Molly Shannon instead of Sherry O'Terry,
I'm a
little like, yeah. Did you not know Sherry O'Terry was there? Like,
did you not know? And I don't know if she did a lot of writing at all. I know like some people do more writing than others, but like, yeah, I guess because her characters, I think, were maybe so, like, her characters weren't so outlandish and gregarious as like Molly Shannon's characters were, I think. And I think Molly Shannon, equally wonderful in her own right, may have kind of outshined her in that way, where like Molly Shannon's characters were very commercial, where I don't think Sherry O'Terry's characters were.
And I think for me growing up, for whatever reason, Molly Shannon was the acquired taste, mm-hmm. where Sherry was like, oh, I get everything you're doing, and I'm on board. Like,
yeah.
And I don't understand what it is. Like, cause I was about to ask you, cause you talked about Modern Times, which one of my comedy theories is that like your favorite Mel Brooks movie is the first one you see.
Mm-hmm.
And of those silent geniuses, your favorite one is the first one you see. So you're either a Charlie Chaplin person because that's the first one you saw. You're a Buster Keaton person because that's the first one you saw.
Mm-hmm.
Harold Lloyd, if you're lucky enough to be that the first one. Because I'm a Buster person because I saw General first, and General blew my mind.
Oh, sure.
And then I see Modern Times, you know, I think like 3 or 4 years ago, I finally watch it. I'm like, oh.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay, yeah, absolutely. Like,
yeah,
this is insane.
And I'm really fortunate because like my grandparents were a little bit older, and like, and their parents were definitely fans of vaudeville and like took them to see vaudevillian shows when they came into the city and stuff. And my dad is a huge comedy buff, and like, so I was also watching like the Three Stooges and stuff when I was a kid, and like learning all about that history and stuff. So I was really lucky to have like comedy was definitely like something in my house. And but yeah, I agree. Like I saw Buster Keaton, you know, probably a couple of years later, just because like Turner Classic Movies had like silent film night or whatever it is, silence and comedy, whatever it was. And I just like loved all of it, but just something about Charlie Chaplin just spoke to me in a way. And I think because of how unabashedly open he was about his sadness and about his hard times with his mom and everything, I think that's why I liked him so much, just because like you can really see how he took his pain and made it into something really beautiful. And that's where I think I'd consider comedians to be artists in that way. It's just because like, you know, what did they say, comedy is just tragedy plus time, but like, yeah, it's the timing that really matters, and you can get it wrong really easily. But I agree. Yeah. Like I'm 100% like, absolutely. It's because I saw Charlie Chaplin when I was like five.
Yeah. Like I mean, you mentioned things like the Three Stooges. Like I was exposed to the Three Stooges early, but I'd only seen the like two of the shorts over and over and over. Like I didn't see the full like breadth of their material. I just saw Mouse in the Palace and Disorder in the Court over and over and over and over and over again. Because they just happened to be the VHS tapes that I had,
sure,
once like all their stuff went to the public domain or something. Cause and everyone was like, hey, here's Three Stooges things. Like I didn't. Okay. So you go to school to be theater, move to communications, but still hang out with theater kids. You still want to do it. Why did you start with stand up?
Because I didn't have the confidence to think that I could get right into improv or sketch, but I had been writing jokes in a stand-up way. Like I had written my first stand-up joke that like I talked about it to a friend and she really liked it. And so there is this art gallery in Kutztown called Eckhouse. I don't know if it's still there, but they had a comedy night of my friends were hosting it, and they asked if I could do stand-up, and I was like, I've never done stand-up a day in my life. They're like, no, but you wrote all those jokes. And I was like, okay. So it was the best 2 minutes of my life that I've ever had. It literally was like 3 minutes. And I just did these two jokes, and they worked. And then it just kind of went from there. And I found writing stand-up jokes to be, I don't want to say easier, but like more, because I didn't know what any of the formulas were, because I didn't read any comedy books. I just kind of was winging it. That I, you know, just kind of went with it. And it was because my friend, Richie and Eric, who had written sketches before, they actually taught me the structure of how to actually write a sketch. And that's how Bill Goes to the Dr. Dentist came to be. But yeah, I just found stand-up to be, for me, a little bit easier. But I discovered that I'm more of a storyteller instead of a stand-up, because, as you know, men have, like, to critique women sometimes, and so it'd be like, oh, it's not really stand-up, it's more like storytelling. And I'm like, did you laugh, like, does it,
like,
2013 sucked back then, man.
The weird things that people come up with, like, to make divisions in stand-up comedy is one of those things that I've completely, like, just gone away from. Like, shut up. Like,
yeah.
Whether you're storytelling or you're the person with the guitar, like,
yeah, it's like you're on stage, you're standing up or whatever, and you're making people laugh. And I, like, think that that's admirable.
You know, the prop comics get their stuff, and, like, okay, I understand not liking Carrot Top, but Carrot Top's a millionaire, and
yeah, like,
he is actually kind of funny. Like, he's,
yeah,
like, and the whole thing, even like Larry the Cable Guy, like the idea of, like, inhabiting a character,
I mean,
and, like, is, because I remember, I, like, the thing I remember at my, like, the height of my comedy, you know, purist nerd, like, I was all about, like, David Cross calling out Larry the Cable Guy.
Yeah,
like when that happened in, you know, like, oh geez, like 15-20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, now I'm like, whatever, David. Yeah. David Cross is as much a character on stage,
yeah,
as Larry the Cable Guy is. Like, it's all persona, it's all,
yeah. And I think you have to be, I think you, like, even a stand-up comedian has to get into some type of character, like you have to, whether it's like, you know, as you step outside of yourself. No stand-up, I mean, I'm gonna make a very grandiose statement, I don't think any stand-up comedian is 100% themselves on stage, because you can't be, like as a performer, you have to protect yourself in that way. And you have yeah, you're filtering yourself, but I know that when I would do stand-up, like, I would, you know, make space between myself and the audience, and just because you have to be. And, like, I'm not nearly as self-deprecating in real life as I am on stage, like, you know. And because you're on stage and people can see you and people can see all your flaws, and to be 100% open about all of them and be like, yeah, keep on, yeah, make fun of me, like, no one can do that.
Yeah.
So if you're able to create this character that clearly people can relate to, millions of people can relate to it, and you're making people laugh, at not at the expense of others, so you're, like, you're not, you know, doing short stuff, you're not, you know, blindsiding anybody, then, like, okay, make your money and make people laugh.
Yeah. Okay, let's fast forward to not the current, but, like,
almost, all right, current.
So you're in roughly 2013. I'm assuming you're still in Bucks County.
Yeah.
How did you find out about comedy in Philadelphia versus making the trek to Reading every week, or however often you do?
Well, Josh, your story is the oldest time. I fell in love. So I had an opportunity to either go to New York City with the two of my friends who left. And then I met somebody and I decided I wanted to explore this option. At the time, I had just went down a deep dive of research. I was just like, what is there comedy in Philly? If there is, where is it? What is it? And that's when I discovered the Philly Improv Theater. And at that point, I really fell in love with improv. I really enjoyed it. I really wanted to do more of it. I didn't know much about long form, but I wanted to learn. And so I, you know, took a class, and that kind of started me in Philadelphia. So I had moved home. I was in Bucks County and I was like, well, commuting 40 minutes is a lot better than
Damn.
an hour and a half.
Yeah.
And so that's what I did. And so that's, and I think I took like a free class, like a free workshop. And then I, that like, I don't know, that summer I started taking a 101 in improv.
How much improv, like how much of the improv curriculum do you do?
I did the whole thing.
Like, is it all improv to start and then you get into sketch or?
Yeah, so it's weird, right? So I didn't want to pay for my classes, so I started volunteering as
right.
soon as possible.
That's the thing I wanted to say. It was that like at that for a while at the time at that fit, you were
there all the
one
time.
Of the faces that was always there, like between volunteering and I think eventually actually working there, like
yeah, I
like oh, it's a teen at night. Okay, cool. Like
yeah, I fell in love with it. And I loved it at the beginning there. I did. I really loved it. And I just wanted to know, I wanted to, I love learning. Right. And like, once I'm obsessed with something and I want to like go as deep far down the rabbit hole as I can. So I was like, I want to know. And I was even strategic with the classes I took. Like I took all my classes with like executive directors or like the director of the theater. Cause I was like, I'm going to know all the people. And so I just started volunteering. And so I was at the theater all the time. And I just started talking to people and I became friends and I would be backstage and I was backstage one night during sketch night. And I don't know. I can't remember. I can't remember if it was Secret Pants or who. I forget what the team was, but I just saw one of the teams, one of all of the many wonderful, great sketch teams that were of that time. And I was just like, that looks freaking awesome. And I didn't realize that like, cause I love the state, right? And I love Kids in the Hall and Saturday Night Live. And I didn't realize and put it together that like you can have sketch live comedy and it's a very different experience.
Yeah.
And I was like, wait, this is an option? This was an option the entire time. And so I just kind of started figuring out what I wanted to do. And then at that point, I had become a house manager. I had already, I think we had already produced Duo Fest at that point, like a couple years later. And then I became friends with our mutual friend, Brian, and I ended up like being a buddy in his class and I took the class. And then I was like, oh yeah, sketch comedy is where like, this is where I fit. And I struggle with writing. I actually struggle with writing with content, but I was like, I can be in sketches and I can find the funny in anything. And I'm like real dependable. And that's kind of how I started getting in bits and stuff because people would have people who would call out or wouldn't show up and I'm already at the theater and I have 10 minutes to kill. So they'd be like, hey, Tina, do you want to be in a bit? I'd be like, yeah, absolutely. And that's kind of how it started. I was just very dependable and always around.
Yeah. I think that was one of the things that with Judo Range, like there was always something where like we had to like pull in some whoever was at the theater like, hey, can you just do this like walk on laugh and move like yeah okay whatever. Like I think I always say that one of the issues with sketch comedians together is schedule, like figuring out getting the schedule together and everything, like
so long.
If you can get like a schedule precisely perfect, you'll be together forever. Like
yep, that's it. That's half the reason.
And then I think the other thing is showing up. Like the more you're around, the more you're there, the more like you're not a turd to people, like
yeah,
and people want to hang out with you. Like that also will open up all the opportunities for you too. Like
yeah, and that's what I felt. And I'd like to think of myself and I hope others see it, is that I think that I am a kind person and I always love to help. If I can help anybody, and as long as I'm not hurting myself in the process, I'm willing to help. And what better way to help somebody than by like putting on a great show? Because I was very proud at the time to like really be there and like be a part of it, and I really wanted all of the shows to be successful. Is even more so when I became a house manager. Like I remember it was one night I didn't have a stand-up opener and one of the variety teams was missing somebody, so I ended up house managing opening the show. And then but because 10 years prior, however many years prior, I remember that I knew to go back to that place to be able to put those different hats on, that I was able to. And it was a great show. And it was like, of course, the like we had a really good turnout. So I was like, I don't want this audience. I think we had like, it was a Friday night. I think there was like 860 people in the audience, which were, you know, fit. And that top theater was really, really huge. I was like, I don't want this to be a bad show. I want this to be a great show. And I want to do everything I can to help put that on. And so that's also probably why some would call me a hard ass as a house manager. But I was like, I want this to be a really good show. And I want this to be, I want us to make people laugh. And so, although I was never like officially on like a house team or anything like that, I definitely got a lot of stage time. And I think that has a lot to do with it, just like being dependable, being on time, being kind, and being, you know, not being afraid to talk to anybody. I walk up to anybody. I think I did that with you. I was like, hey man, what's going on? And you're like, hi.
And I'm very much not the person, like, as much as doing this podcast and like my role now with Philly Sketchfest, back then that was not a thing. Like, I am not a walk up to and say hi person. Like,
I'm drawn to those types.
it's almost an act of war to me. Like, all right. What are your memories of It's the New?
Oh, It's the New. I love them. Actually, our 6-year anniversary show had to come up on my newsfeed. We were a ragtag group of friends. I joined that group late. They needed another actor. But I was friends with all of them. I was friends with Andrew and Gabby and Bill. And Bill was actually a roommate with me. He lived with me for like a year, which was great. It's the New was just, like I said, we made each other laugh and we had a lot of fun. We could all get together. We would rehearse at my house. It was just fun. And then we had this wonderful opportunity to do the show Sketchworks, where it was like a variety show. And that's where I think I started getting the confidence to start writing more, and also getting the confidence of being able to like, oh, I know when something works. Like, I can find the funny in this, and like, I can make this work. And I think the biggest compliment I ever got was when Bill had written a sketch. He wrote in me in mind, and he said, he's like, this is a shell, do whatever you want to it. And I was just really honored by that. And it was great. It was just, we had so much fun. I think my favorite show we did was It's the Dew. And it was, our theme was It Mountain Dew. And at the end of the show, I was house managing, so I didn't care. But we basically shook up bottles of Mountain Dew and just went everywhere on the stage. The only reason why we did it was because I was
just saying that you can only do that when you know you're the one that's cleaning it up. Like,
exactly. And they were very respectful and helped me. But I think we wanted to be weird and silly and find weird and silly people and put them up. And that's why I really enjoyed that showcase, because we just did crazy weird stuff and we just had a lot of fun, because like one of our teammates was the tech booth operator, so like we could put on these crazy outlandish tech pieces because he was there. I was a house manager, so like I knew that like what we could do within reason, you know. Andrew was an improviser, so like he could move all over the place and do all sorts of crazy things. But I miss them so much.
Yeah. Did you ever, like, did you start to have a preference between improv and sketch?
Yes. And and if I'm honest, it was because I had auditioned for, I don't know, 20 or 30 improv shows, and I didn't get cast in any of them. And I was just like, all right, well, clearly this is not for me. Clearly I don't have something that they're looking for.
Yeah.
And I'm not gonna waste my energy. And like, you know, and I was just like I could just tell like politics and like cronyism was getting in the way. So I was like, you know what, I'm just gonna stick with what I have. And I really love that my style of sketch comedy, and that the sketch and the people that I was working with, there was an opportunity to improvise. In fact, one of the shows that It's the New, it was our Tim Allen show that we did. It was like Home Improvement themed. Mm-hmm. We had like, we were short on time, and I just improvised a monologue about how Jonathan Taylor Thomas like was part of my sexual awakening. None of it was true. I made it completely all up on the spot. And it was like 3.5 minutes or something crazy. And like, I think I told Jack just to black me out whenever he felt ready to, which he did. And that's what I loved about it, was that I could do stuff like that, but then also like do these elaborate written out sketches, and I just felt that I ended up getting more freedom in sketch than I did in improv.
You're mentioning shows from It's the New, and they're totally like jogging my memory. Like, I definitely remember a lot of Tim Allen material.
Oh, this is one of our
for months with y'all. Like,
it was so good. It was so good. And that's like all Jack and Drew and Bill and Andrew. Like, they were, and Gabby and Jackie, like, they definitely did a lot of that writing. Most of the writing, if not all. And like, they were just like, God, they're so smart and so funny.
Do you ever get the itch to do stand-up again?
Yes, actually, I've been, so like, I had some like life changes and stuff in the last couple of years, and I definitely have written jokes that I'm like, this doesn't work for a sketch, this
right.
doesn't work for a monologue, because like, I've been doing a lot of monologue writing as well. And so I was like, maybe I just go to an open mic and just do a 2-minute set and see how it feels. So I definitely am thinking of that.
How was I've been asking this question for a lot of people, like, I mean, when I do this, but like, we all had to deal with the pandemic, and we all had to deal with, even though it's a hobby, even or however we want to categorize it, something was taken away from us for a couple years, comedy wise. Like, Philadelphia, comedy in Philadelphia is just, I mean, sketch comedy in Philadelphia is just starting to get moving again. Like, stand up came back a little quicker, improv came back a little quicker, but so how did you deal with the pandemic from a comedy perspective?
Not great, my dude. So part of it was I was kind of hitting a stride professionally and performing wise. Like, I had booked a gig on a TV show that never came to be. It was a very, very small part, but it was like nothing. Like, but it was still really cool. Then I was going to be in a show that was going to be at the Kimmel Center and part of the Academy of Music. Like, I was like crescending into like the T-Nut glory, and I was all excited. And then like, all of the productions were supposed to be like March, April, May of 2020. I was very fortunate that right before the pandemic, I had gotten back into improv. But I was in Story Up, which was like the Martha Cooney and her teams. They did like children's
for kids, right? Improv.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause that's where I found my target audience is not adults, it's children. And that's what I realized. Is I can make kids laugh no matter what I'm doing. And they put on improvised, basically they had kids write stories and then we kind of put them up online. And that was a really great respite. And then like I did some online stuff that just wasn't great. But it was, for me personally, it was really, really difficult because the way that I express myself, like, I'm 100% extroverted. I think anybody who knows me knows that I'm not an introvert at all. Even like my, like, fill my well days of when I need to be alone is maybe like an hour. And then I'm like, let's do something out and going and
like, I've recharged. Let's go. Like,
let's do it. Yeah.
Where my recharge is like 5 days. Like,
right. And so for me, it was a completely different set of like existence. And it was really hard. It was definitely really hard. And I wrote some stuff and I kept writing and I tried to be creative. And I think some people like were putting up some stuff here and there, but I just kind of rode the depression wave and was like, you know what? Like, end times, baby, let's see what happens.
So, and as we're walking into this and, you know, I start doing Cutthroat, one of the things I was really hoping for was to start giving the students that were going through Crossroads here in Philly a spot to perform.
Love it.
But then there's also a part of me, I was like, I want to see who's coming out of the woodwork, like, who's still in the city, who still wants to do stuff. So like, and I told you this when I eventually saw you again, I was like, when you signed up, it was a full heck yeah, let's go, let's bring it back, come on. Like, like, you were one of the people that signed up that I like thrilled me. I was so happy that you, like, to get you back in. I'm like, all right, like, I think I even texted my friend Julia, like Julia Hudson, like, Tina signed up for Cutthroat, I gotta like make sure she stay, like, we gotta keep her around. Like, So we're in this new world, and you've met new people, and you're with this. So tell me about In Action Network. What's going on?
Yeah, In Action Network is the brainchild of, I believe, several cutthroat sketch teams that have fused together. So Tristan, who was in both of the teams, they all loved really working together. And so he was like, let's get together. And then Tristan was part of my cutthroat sketch team that I was like the mentor of. And they were wonderful and great. And so he kind of like pushed us all together. And so this kind of started. And, you know, I've, again, some life stuff. So I haven't been as active as I would like, but they are doing some really, really great work. And they just have this really cool concept of a news station and like doing the news. And it's like if, you know, 6ABC was in the topsy-turvy world and like what's gonna happen. But it's really, really cool. I equate it to like a mono scene, which it's like if we're gonna throw improv back into it. But it's really cool, and they've like banged out some really fun stuff, and they're just really fun to work with, and they're really silly. And like if I can read a sketch and I go, that's so dumb, oh my god, it means it's like the best thing I've ever read.
And I think a lot of like, because a bunch of us have that in our heads, like when I talk to Sam Russell and Brian Craig, we are very much in the that's so dumb is the one of the highest compliments we can give you. Like,
oh my god.
Like when there's such a dumb idea. You know, it's just a like, and all of this is going to sound bad to certain people, but like that one note sketch where it's just that one dumb idea, it's so good. Like, yeah, comedy is so good sometimes.
Yeah, it really is. No, and I love it. And it's like, I think we can get away with some stuff in Philly that we can't in other places. I think one, Philadelphia comedy is way more collaborative than New York or Chicago, or even LA, because one, I've seen numbers here, there is a lot less of us in Philadelphia than there are in New York and Chicago and LA. But I also think, like, because we're all friends with each other, you know, like for the most part, like I know people who are show running, you know, across the city, and like I know, you know, we all kind of know each other, that like there's no sense of like, oh, you know, Secret Pants got booked on this show, well, F them. It's like, no, it's like, I'm gonna go see that show. Like, it's very much more supportive, I think, than what, because I've done shows in New York and I've just been like, this feels tense, this feels very intense right now.
For all of us that might have aspirations to do other things on stage, to, you know, do TV or whatever else, we're not as like forward with it as New Yorkers are.
Yeah, or those people went and did those things. Like, that's also, yeah, like I have a lot of people I know that did improv that now do live in LA and are doing great and like doing all these wonderful things. And obviously, like, there's different exposure, right? Like, if I was just to do improv and like that was my end all be all, I would probably move to Chicago, like, because like their improv scene is way much more vibrant and I mean, I would argue than Philly, just, but like that's kind of where it started, so like makes sense.
Yeah.
But like I just love how like I can go to a showcase show or I can go to a sketch show and I know I'm gonna watch something real weird, and it's gonna be really weird and really funny and I'm gonna love it.
What are you looking to get out of comedy now? Like,
I'm no longer trying to like, I want to make money off this, because like I'm doing well in my like day job, that I thought like I had to do, I thought my only way of being successful in comedy was if I could make like monetary income off of it. That's what I was thinking. And it's like, now that I've gotten older and I do see like what fame can do and like what fame can do to a comedian, I'm not so interested in that. I want to be able to, you know, pay for the things that I need to pay for to do my comedy. Like, a lot of my monologues are very like costume heavy. And so like, I need to like buy all the stuff to make those costumes. But I also am not looking to make any like monetary gain. Obviously, yes, if I get like $10, that's great. But I'm looking just to express myself differently. And I think my voice has changed a bit since I started doing comedy. I think I'm definitely more mature in that regard. But I'm just looking to reconnect with old friends and collaborate again and just really make people laugh, because it's been real rough for all of us. And so I think the best thing that I can do, and I say this to everybody, is the reason why I do this is because if I can get on stage and make you forget about something that you want to forget for 5 minutes, that to me is worth more than any fame or fortune. And I know that sounds trite, but it's true.
I had never thought about it that way, but Matt and Jackie just had their 10-year anniversary show. Like,
so bummed I couldn't go. I couldn't go. I was so mad.
And Paul Trigg from Secret Pants and from everything else in Philadelphia hosted the show. And he said that, like, I'm going to screw it up a little bit, but he said, if we don't make your life better for the hour we're on stage, then we failed.
Yep.
And I was just like, oh yeah, that's all we're doing is just trying to make this hour better than than the previous hour or whatever it was. Like, yeah, that's enough.
Yeah.
Like, that's fine.
And I think that's what I love. I think of all the things that I've done, like all the things that I've tried to do and all of the things that like other creative endeavors that I've tried. Because I've tried, like, you know, I've tried singing and being in a band and all these things. And it's like, none of that gives me the same satisfaction that I get that, like, when I see, because, like, you can tell sympathy laughter versus real laughter. You can tell that right away. When I'm able to realize that something very stupid that I wasn't really confident about that I wrote from somebody that doesn't know me is able to find it really funny and gets joy out of it, like, it's like I've snorted like 10 lines of cocaine. Like, I'm just like, I'm ready to freaking go. Like,
first off, that's a lot of cocaine. Like, that might be too much cocaine.
I don't know. I've never done it, so I don't know.
I'm saying that feels like, I have no experience either, but that feels like a lot.
It's like, that's excessive.
You probably could have said two or three, and I would have been okay with that metaphor.
Very hyperbolic, yes.
All right, as we're winding down, we touched on a little bit already, but like, first off, I ask all, what's a piece of advice that you would give to a new sketch writer, performer?
Ooh, am I at that age? It would be, the only people who are going to know you messed up are you. And if you have a director, your director, the audience won't know unless you tell them. And I think that means a lot. And also with that, just take a breath, because 30 seconds in your head is not actually 30 seconds on stage. And I guess it's three things, and know that something's going to go wrong. It's live comedy. Like I've been in shows where the tech didn't work at all and I had to do a show in complete darkness. Like, it just happens. And it's like, if your content is funny, then the show will be great. And that those three things I think will help make a really like strong writer and strong performer.
And we did talk about this a little bit already, like, you had mentioned doing other artistic ventures and stuff, but it basically came back to doing comedy. So why comedy? Why has comedy been one path for you to spend your time?
It's, believe it, Joan Rivers and Louis C.K. that says, we don't do this because we want to do it. We do it because it's a calling. And I truly believe that. I think you can teach technique, you can teach history, you can teach a Herald, you can teach, you know, how to write two-person sketches. You can teach all of that. Like, those are skills that you can teach. But the actual, like, reading something, or like knowing how long 2 minutes really is, or just feeling it and like, no, feeling that tingle in the back of your spine when something's really funny, that's a gift and that's a calling. And I think for me, there's nothing else that I can do, because it's the only thing in my world that has ever made sense. Like, if I can't find the funny in life, then I shouldn't be alive anymore. Like, that's how I'll know my time is up.
I'm always like, what's the funny in, like, there has to be something funny in this, but there has to be something absurd. Like, yeah, I'm always like, yeah, I fully on
I
board
think
that.
I think my Tinder profile says that I'm fun at parties and I put the fun in funerals.
I am wildly inappropriate at funerals. Like if my sister and I are in the same room, she's getting texted the entire time, like
Yes.
because I don't deal well with real feelings. So
Yeah, oh no.
I'm gonna go over with, making jokes.
Absolutely.
All right. Thanks, T-Nut.
Thanks for having me.
Like I said, February 28th, Sketchball featuring In Action Network and J&M doing some musical comedy to open up. 7:30 p.m. at Plays and Players, the Skinner Studio on the third floor. $15 tickets are available at sketchballphilly.com/tickets. And you can follow In Action Network on Instagram at In Action Network. The March edition of Cutthroat Sketch entitled Spring returns to Salabona on March 7th at 7:30. cutthroatsketch.com/tickets. Philly Sketch Fest returns in all of its glory May 31st through June 8th. If you want to submit your live act, head to phillysketchfest.com/submit2024. And if you have a short film you'd like to submit to the film festival on June 5th, phillysketchfest.com/film2024. My First Sketch is a Philly Sketch Fest production. You can find out more information at phillysketchfest.com. Follow Philly Sketchfest on Instagram at phillysketchfest. The music on this episode is by the band No-No, which you can check out at nonoband.bandcamp.com. Like My First Sketch on Facebook, follow the show on Twitter, rate, review, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. This is Josh Hyam. Thanks for listening. Go see some comedy.